I love being the mystery woman. My name is Ellen Cassidy, and I'm an enthusiastic, boundlessly grateful Al-Anon. And you are my kind of people. You know, there are some places that look at me just dumbfounded when I start talking, and they're like, oh, no, no, too much Al-Anon, tone it down. And there's no such thing, you know, there's no such thing. The energy level at Seaside, after a while, conferences tend to blend for me, you know, you've been in one rectangle state, you've been in them all, you know, and, you know, Merp knows. But this one stands out. When I was here the last time, I left here brimming with the energy you had. You are an amazing, amazing bunch of people, and I feel so grateful to be back with you again. Thank you for having me. I didn't tell her anything because I'm just never sure. You know, what do I tell her? That, you know, oh, that I was this in a former life, or I think I'm this now, or, you know, Al-Anons are not good at those kind. I need, like, a multiple choice. Give me, like, three or four things, I'll pick one, you know. I just can't pick them out of the air. I just make stuff up, you know what I mean? So better not to tell you anything. I introduce myself as an Al-Anon. I will tell you that my very first meeting was November 4th of 1981. They told me when I came to my first meeting that if I decided not to stay, my misery would be refunded. I have not seen it necessary to check that out. Plenty of other people have gone out there and checked it out for me, and it's not any better. I have stayed gratefully for 25 and a half years. I sometimes hesitate to tell you when I came in, because you know, you hear my story and you go, God, this is as good as it gets after 25 years. But you should have seen me. You can talk to Beverly later, because she was there when I came in, so you can talk to Bev. I introduced myself as an Al-Anon. I feel the need to explain that. That's not good news. Explaining things is how I got to Al-Anon. I always thought if I could get you to listen long enough, if I could find the right combination of words, then you'd understand. Then you'd see why my way, really is the better way, and you'd agree to do it, and we'd all be happy. It's one of those places where God has taken what looked to be a defect of character and uses it now as an asset. He says, you have developed that explaining muscle very well. Just get out there, explain, honey, explain your heart away. And tonight's your night in the barrel. Al-Anon's not what I wanted to be when I grew up. I think from my first breath, and maybe even before that, I'm not sure. But what I always wanted to be from the very beginning was I wanted to be somebody's wife and somebody's mother, and I was going to be the best wife he ever had, and I was going to be the best mother those children ever had. I'd been in Al-Anon a couple of years before I realized that never, ever had I in my whole life wanted to be me. I didn't want to be the best mother Ellen could be. I wanted to be the best in somebody else's eyes. I wanted the children to say, that's the best mother anybody could have, instead of being the best mother I could be. What I ended up being was somebody's judge and somebody's juror and somebody's executioner, and none of us were happy. When I got to Al-Anon, I hadn't been here very long, and I decided that what I really wanted to be was alcoholic. And I had a couple of reasons for that. Number one, it was very apparent to me that alcoholic women had more fun than we did. And apparently my husband preferred them, so... I'm just reporting is all I'm doing. So I decided I would like to be alcoholic. Now, but of course I never wanted to be who I was, where I was. I always wanted to be someplace else with somebody else doing something else. So here I am, it's another one of my solutions, the same solution, just with a different face on, that I'm going to be alcoholic. Well, I wasn't going to drink to be alcoholic because, I had a couple of reasons for that. And if you're an explainer, you need lots of reasons. I had a couple of reasons. Number one, I had gone to a lot of open AA meetings, and I had heard this deal about there's a line someplace, and you might cross the line, and most people who cross the line don't get back across on the other side of the line. And I had two drinks every night, and I enjoyed both of them. Really, both of them. Did I ever have three? No. No. One time I did. It was New Year's Eve. Oh, I was so sick. I can remember it. A lot of my life is a big blur, but I remember that next morning. Nothing was worth that. Well, I don't think I'm an alcoholic, but anyway. I was afraid that if I let myself, but of course I was afraid of everything. But anyway, I was afraid if I let myself drink a whole lot and to see if I could make myself alcoholic, you know, that I might not get back across the line. So that was one reason I wasn't going to drink to be alcoholic. The other reason was that I needed to be alcoholic that afternoon, and I really didn't have time. So, my solution, when I'm in my dis-ease, my dis-easiness, my solution is always the same. I think if you change how it looks on the outside, it's going to change how I feel on the inside. And I might have to change how the relationship looks. I might have to change him. I might have to change a belief I have about something, a principle I have. I might have to change something so that I can feel better on the inside. So really, all I had to really do was look alcoholic. That was all I had to do. Now, I need to tell you that alcoholic women have saved my life. I didn't come into Al-Anon surrendered, and I don't know that many of us do. I came into Al-Anon looking for one more thing that might work. I came into Al-Anon looking for power. I came into Al-Anon looking for a way to get him sober so my life would be okay. What happened to me was I hung around in Al-Anon long enough for surrender to happen. And you know what? Surrender is not really a feeling, it's an experience. And if you haven't had that experience yet, if you're not sure, you haven't had it. But keep coming, because I tell you something. Life gives you, you can hear it in Donna's story, just one breath right after the other. Life offers you a chance to surrender on a regular basis. And if you miss it, that's okay. There's another one coming right behind it. It's a little more painful. A few more people are going to watch you fall down. You'll probably scream a little louder. You missed that one, it's okay. Life is consistent, and there will be another chance to surrender. And my chance to surrender came my first chance that I was cognizant of, came 3 years into the program. And when it happened, it was the alcoholic women who saved my life. It was the alcoholic women who came to me and said, "We know about the black hole. We know how you feel." It was an alcoholic woman who came to me and said, "Honey, those Al-Anons mean well." She said, "What you need is 448 through 452, third edition. And you need it every day till you don't need it anymore." And you know what? I still need those pages. I still need those Dr. Paul pages on acceptance. And so when I tell you that I love alcoholic women better than my own breath, let me tell you that I came into Al-Anon in gorgeous North Dallas. So I had a pretty limited view of alcoholic women. So what I did that afternoon was to change my clothes. And I put on skin-tight jeans and stiletto heels. I made a couple of discoveries in that little experiment. Number one, I didn't like anything control me like those pants did. And number two, Al-Anons are really doomed to sensible shoes. We're built for speed and not for looks. You know, if you love an alcoholic, you have got to be ready to go in a heartbeat. Or you could not only lose him, but kill yourself in the attempt. Now, the place I decided to do this little experiment was at the Crested Butte Mountain Conference in Crested Butte, Colorado, with 600 of my closest friends. And they just humor me. You know, they always have just humored me. Look at her now. New clothes, Elle. I'm sure I borrowed someone else's. And the week that I decided to try this little experiment, this was 1983 or 84, and there were there that weekend, that week, it's a week-long conference, there were four people who had between them 125 years of Al-Anon, which was a lot of Al-Anon 20 years ago. I not only heard their stories, I not only got to go to meetings with them, but I got to spend time one-on-one with them. Most importantly, I got to watch their interactions with their families. And I finally knew what it was I wanted to be when I grew up. I want that freedom that's offered me in step three, the freedom to be who it is God would have me be. I want to be free from that bondage of myself and my old ideas and myself. self-pity and my self-centeredness. I want to be free. So, I walked away from there so grateful that there was such a thing as Al-Anon, and somehow, by God's grace, I had landed here. You know what I think about God's grace? I think God's grace is like rain. It falls on the just and the unjust. It falls on those who get in here, and it falls on those who don't get in here. But somehow God's grace parted the way and let me in here. When I was 17, my mama diagnosed me. Mama diagnosed me as boy crazy. And the place my mama sent me to be safe was in Lubbock, Texas. And Lubbock, Texas is where the very first Al-Anon meeting in the entire state of Texas was held. Because Lubbock is a dry area. It's where they tell alcoholics they can't drink. And nothing will make them drink faster than tell them they can't drink, you know. But the good news for a girl like me who was always on the hunt for him was that it didn't take me long to find him. Because in dry areas, they're all in the same place. They're just right outside of town. And I was hunting him, and I found him. He was married to somebody else and had two kids and was 60 pounds overweight, but none of that seemed unsurmountable to me. I personally have never liked the easy ones. You know, I don't like the ones who come up and go, "Oh, you're so cute, could I?" No! Get away from me! I want those ones you have to fight for, you know? Those ones you have to make love you! And I can do it, too. I know I can. I still got it. I can feel it in my bones. I can do it. And then after you get them, you go, "My trophy! See what I did?" It's good for about a week, week and a half. And then you're like, "Huh. That it?" Well, a year later, we'd shed the wife to two kids and the 60 pounds, and I had my prize. Oh, lucky, lucky me. Married 6 months when he hit me the first time. He was drunk when he hit me. He was drunk every time he hit me. I didn't grow up in a family where adults hit on each other, so the response I had, the reaction I had to that was nothing anybody taught me. I thought of it all by myself. I manufactured it in this fabulous solution area I have between my ears. You know, I have come to discover that the problems in my life are not really the problems in my life. The problems in my life are the solutions I come up with for what I perceive to be the problems in my life. I'm in a lot more trouble with my solutions than I ever was with the problems. The very best thing I could think to do was double dog dare him to do it again. You know, I'd been in Al-Anon a while before that started to not make sense to me anymore, you know? I have younger brothers. I mean, that's how you bully your younger brothers. "Oh, yeah! Oh, yeah!" And I had corrective shoes as a younger kid, you know, and they didn't dare cross me because I'd just look them in the eye and go, "Boo!" You know, one of them's got permanent scars on his legs where mother told me to watch him. So I was in charge and I watched him bleed sometimes. You know, for a while, we went on like that for another 9 years, because I don't know about you, but I'm a sticker. I'll make my bed and I'll damn near die in it is what I'll do. And it wasn't until I never told anybody a word about that abuse, never said a thing to anybody till I got to Al-Anon. And I did a number of inventories. I did a lot of talking about that. I not so very long ago, I was talking to a therapist one time and I was telling her about what happened. And she said, "Do you know how flatly you said that?" I said, "Do you know how many times I've said it? All the emotion is gone out of it. It has nothing, there's no hooks left in that anymore for me. That's gone." What I discovered is that for some length of time, I continued to volunteer. I was a volunteer in that situation because I volunteered for the abuse. I would double dog dare him to do it. And it didn't take any more insanity on his part to hit me the second time than it did the first time. At some point, I crossed the line. And I went from the volunteer to the victim. I don't know when it happened, but as a result of doing inventory, I know today how it happened. Every time he hit me and I believed what he said, which was if I hadn't done what I did, he wouldn't have to do what he did. Every time he hit me and I believed what he said, which was I deserved that. Every time he hit me and I got up the next morning and I looked in the mirror at a black eye or a split lip or a bloody nose and I said to myself, it's not that bad. I'll just stay in the house a couple more days and it'll clear up enough that makeup will cover it and nobody will know. Every time I did that, a piece of me left and another piece and another piece and another piece until 9 years later, there was nobody left who could stand up and say, you can't treat me like that. I'm God's precious child. The reason I left him was because somebody else came along who said, you don't have to live like that, which I'd heard plenty of times before. But this one added the magic words, and I love you. Oh, I'm on the hunt again. When I came to Al-Anon, my observation has been that those of us who come into Al-Anon tend to come in with one of two feelings. We either come in angry or we come in hurt. And if you come in angry, you're going to have to learn to deal with hurt. And if you come in hurt, you're going to have to learn to deal with the anger. It's the same feeling. It's the same energy. It's just whether we've pushed it out on somebody else or we're sucking it all in on us. And I came in with hurt. I hurt. And I was very sensitive, really, I was, because everything hurt me. It just hurt. I remember watching angry people at my meeting, and they scared me. You know, I didn't like angry people. I was really a little afraid of them, but I envied them. Oh, I remember watching Nikita Khrushchev bang his shoe on a table one time, and I went, wow, that is so cool. Wish I could do that, but I can't. So when I had another feeling besides hurt, I wanted to call my sponsor and tell her. I knew she'd be pleased. So I called my sponsor and I said, guess what? I have a new feeling. She said, terrific. Terrific. What is it? I said, fear. She said, great. What are you afraid of? And I'm like, do I need to know that, you think? She said, oh, yeah, it's very helpful if you know what it is you're afraid of. Really, it is. Well, and that, you know, it's the standard Al-Anon answer. I don't know. She said, of course you do. You're the only person who knows, and I'll stay with you while you figure it out. My sponsor believed that you should chase your fears to their root cause. It's never the surface one. There's always more below it. So she said, what are you afraid of? Well, I said, I'm afraid. I'll tell you, I know exactly what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid he's going to leave me. She said, why are you afraid of that? And I said, because he told me that he's leaving. She said, when is he leaving? And I said, Friday. And she said, I'll tell you something. You know how you know an alcoholic's leaving you? When they're gone. Oh, write that down in my notebook of Al-Anon notes to keep, you know. She said, okay, well, let's say he's leaving you. Now how do you feel? Let's say he's gone. Now how do you feel? Are you still afraid? Oh, yes, I'm still afraid. She said, okay, so what are you afraid of now? Well, I don't know. Yes, you do. I'll be here. Okay, so what I got to, and it was a long travel, and I'd like to tell you I did it in a half hour, but I think it took days to do this. I was afraid he was going to leave me. I was afraid he was going to leave me by myself. And this is a little baby fear, but it's the one that ruled my life. I'm not enough. I'm not smart enough. I'm not wise enough. I don't have enough money. There's not enough time. I'm not enough. I won't be able to take care of myself. It's a little baby fear, but it ruled my life. And below that is, if I can't take care of myself, I'll just die. And I've realized in the last several years there's another fear under that one. I'm going to die and there is no God. That was my bottom line fear. So it became life and death that he stay with me. So when someone said I love you to me, what I heard was I'll stay with you. I won't leave you. I'll take care of you. Now it took me a year to track him down, but I'm like the Mounties. I always get my man. And after a year, I had him. Oh, lucky, lucky me. Now, I knew what I'd done wrong the first time, and I was not doing those things again. This one was the right height, right age, right coloring, right family, right education, right job. Everything was perfecto. Except for this one little teeny tiny flaw he had. He didn't come home nights. But, you know, I'm thinking a couple of home-cooked meals and a little, you know, and I got him. That's the way I marked my territory back there when I cared, you know. Ever since menopause, who cares, you know. Makes me tired just to think about it. But anyway, I worked my magic. And he came home every night. Because it is, of course, all about me. You do know that. It's all about me. He came home every night. Until the night he didn't come home. And I lay on the floor of the bathroom and I cried because I was pretty sure he'd seen the 2 pounds I gained, and that's why he didn't love me anymore, and that's why I wasn't coming home. And then I decided, oh, stupid, stupid me, this morning when he said, what's for dinner? I said, roast beef. And everybody knows pork chops are his favorite thing. And I made myself a promise that from then on, whenever he said, what's for dinner, I was always going to say, pork chops. And then he'd come home. And then I decided what I needed to do was go sit out on the sofa and wait. Now, if you are in training for Al-Anon, you must pass graduate waiting. And the way that you know you are in graduate waiting is if when you are waiting, you can do nothing else. You can't talk on the phone, you can't read a book, you can't watch TV, you can't wash the clothes, you can't cook a meal. The kids would come up and they'd go, Mom, and I'd go, I can't talk to you, I'm waiting. And that's because while I was waiting, I was listening. And I was listening for the sound of those tires. There are 44 bazillion other tires on the planet. Don't care about them. Only care about those tires. And I'll tell you something. I have the same physical reaction to the sound of those tires as I've heard alcoholics say a drink did for them. Because I would hear the sound of those tires and I'd go, he's home. It's going to be okay. Everything's going to be okay. He's home. Now, my next thought might be, I'm killing him when he walks in the door. But at least he'll die in his own bed, you know. And it was always preferable to be a widow, you know, than a divorcee, you know. So, but of course he came home. I recognize now that 99 times out of 100, they come home. It might be that day or the next week or 3 years later, but they come home. And I met him at the door like a three-year-old who's been crying all afternoon, and you've said, stop it. I was at that place, you know, with the snot slinging everywhere and the big puffy eyes, you know. I think about that, and I think, no wonder he drank. You know, if that's waiting for me at home, I'll just have another, okay, you know. And I asked the second stupidest question we can ask. The stupidest, of course, is, have you been drinking? The second stupidest is, where have you been? Because in my head, I already knew where he was, in my solution center. You know, I'd already come up with where he was. In my mind, as I stood there at the window, watching the traffic go by, looking for his truck, Peg Martin said one time, these are not wrinkles, these are Venetian blind marks right here. I knew in my head what had happened to him. And this is the story my head told me. My head said, I don't know why, but he's gone out in the country just driving. I don't know why he has it all by himself. And oh my God, look, his car has blown up. It has. It's blown him in this ditch by the side of the road. And he's really badly injured. He is. And he's, people are going by, but they can't see him because he's down in the ditch. And he's bleeding. And he's not quite dead yet. And with his dying breath, he's calling me. And he's saying, Ellen! Ellen! I love you. And now wild animals are coming and strewing body parts in the forest, and it'll be 7 years before we can identify the body. Well, I called that love. And if you love people, you worry about them like that. You know, that's the way you worry about them. I've come to understand that that's obsession. And you know it's obsession if in your mind somebody dies. That's obsession. You know what obsession is? It's all-out warfare on powerlessness. The more powerless I feel, the more obsessed I get. And I might get obsessed about the thing I'm powerless over, and I might pick out something else altogether. I'm an equal opportunity obsessor. I can do it about my kids. I can do it about my weight. I can do it about your weight. I can do it about politics. I can do it about his job. I can do it about the weather. I've been doing it about the weather this afternoon because the weather in Dallas, Texas is not good tonight. So I've been doing it about the weather because there's a lot I can do about it. But I haven't seen anybody dead, so I think I got out of that quick enough. So that's what I was doing, was I was obsessing. And when he came to the door, he said, Jesus, God. Well, you have certainly worked yourself up into a state, Missy. And he said, you knew where I was. Well, the truth of the matter is I knew where he was. He only went three places. He was at work, he was at home, or he was in the trap room drinking. But see, I have the ability to holding opposing thoughts and they never touch. And my two thoughts were, number one, he loves me more than anything in the world. And number two, he's in the trap room drinking. And if number one is true, number two cannot be true. And my life depended on number one, that he loved me more than anything in the world. And in my diseasiness, I'd rather wish him dead than know the truth. And that's what I did. And he said, yes, I think you're about as crazy as your mother. The big one, Elizabeth. And he said, I don't know why I stay married to you. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Now, what is the matter with this picture? He is 3 hours late and drunk, and I'm the dude standing at the door apologizing, you know. I have an addiction to mind-altering men. Although I've discovered it's not limited to men. Because it's taken me a while in Al-Anon to discover that they're not the ones screwing up my head. It's me screwing up my head. I can do it with anybody. You don't even have to participate. You don't even have to be in the room. I can do it all by myself. Well, we rocked on like that and for a couple of years. And then I got a call at work one day from this lady who was an angry lady at the place where I worked. And I told you I don't like angry people. I didn't like them. Angry people scared me. It was a lot like alcoholism as far as I was concerned, because you never knew what they were going to do next. And I always need to know what you're going to do next, you know. I'd like to know what's going to happen. Please, God, just tell me. And I say so I can be prepared. It's another word for in control is what that means. I think if an Al-Anon had written the big book, it would have said lack of control. That was our dilemma. And I'm not so sure it isn't the same thing. I'm not so sure it's just not semantics. But anyway, this lady called, and she was crying. Now, here's a little thing I didn't tell you. I'm not sure why, but apparently I'm going to tell you now. When I got to Al-Anon, I didn't have very many opinions. I have very strong opinions today. It's neither good nor bad. It's just different, and that's pretty much all I'm offered here is a different way of life. And one of the things I have strong opinions about are people being called Al-Anon. And if you want to watch the hair on my neck stand up, let me be in the room when some new drunk comes dragging in the door, and somebody says, oh, look, there's John, the new drunk, and there's Abby, his little Al-Anon wife, twitching in behind him. Because we always come in with a twitch, you know. And the only reason they're calling her Al-Anon is because she's twitching in behind John. She is not an Al-Anon, she's an alligator. Al-Anon is not a program for people who need it. Statistics are. Are you knitting down there? Zan, is that what you're doing? Never mind. She doesn't want me to pay any attention to her. She hides from me all the time, Zan does. She does it in other states. Ah, we all see you, Zan. Love you, Zan. Anyway, statistics, which are also very important for explainers. Statistics are, for every alcoholic, there are 1 to 4 people profoundly affected. There are 10 to 42 people directly affected for every alcoholic. Who do you suppose that leaves on the planet? Nobody. And some of us have way more than our share, you know what I mean? This meeting ought to be 10 to 42 times bigger than the one my evil twin is gonna talk for you tomorrow night. it's not a happening thing. You know, as hard as it is to get into AA, it's just me, because I've never tried to get into AA, but I think it's harder to come to Al-Anon. It's darn near impossible to come in and ask for help when there's nothing the matter with you. You know what? The alcoholics always wait to see if we're going to laugh. And if we don't laugh at that, they're not going to laugh. They think we don't know that. I love that one, sort of slowly builds. It takes a while after you come to Al-Anon to realize there's something the matter with you. I mean, it's so obvious what the problem is, for God's sake. You know, it's bigger than Montana. But it takes us a while. And as hard as it is to get to Al-Anon, it's really hard to stay. Because I don't think most of us come surrendered. I think most of us come looking for one more thing that might work. You know, I go to this fabulous Al-Anon group, and most of the time we stick to solution. We share our own experience, strength, and hope, and we stick to solution. But every once in a while, somebody will want to tell an old war story about what happened the last time old Georgie got drunk. And he passed out. And she poured fingernail polish in one of his open orifices someplace, and old Georgie got up the next morning and looked down and went, "Oh my God," and old Georgie's been sober ever since, you know. And you watch the newcomer in the room go, "Huh." You know, you got to pray for her, Georgie, because that boy could be in for an awakening the next day. But chances are 99 out of, one out of a million that it's going to be a spiritual experience, let me tell you. If that sounds like a good solution to you, just trust me, it is not. It is not. We are the last people on the planet to get the ones we love sober. We are the last ones. We can talk to them till we're blue in the face. I married this dude up here, I'll tell you about it later on, and he'd been with me for a lot of years before that. We'd known each other forever and ever, amen, and I'd tell him these fabulous things about Al-Anon and AA, and he went to meetings with me even though he was not afflicted at that point. He says he dated his way into Alcoholics Anonymous, but anyway. When this newly sober guy who's just on fire with AA, and he'd come home from a meeting and he'd say, "Guess what I heard at the meeting tonight?" And he'd tell me something, and I'd think to myself, "Holy God, I've been telling you that for 6 years now." He can't hear it come out of my mouth. Cannot hear it come out of my mouth. So if that sounds like a good solution, it really isn't. Really, it's not. Al-Anon is not a program for people who need it. Al-Anon's not even a program for people who want it. We get a lot of newcomers at our meeting who come in, and sometimes the laughter draws them in, and sometimes the laughter repels them. Because alcoholism isn't funny. It's a deadly disease. It kills the people who have it, and it kills the people who love them. You know who uses the insurance first in an alcoholic home? The non-alcoholic. Alcoholics have blessed moments of blackout. Not us. We are awake and paying attention. Sometimes we're even taking notes. We are afflicted with all kinds of stress-related diseases, and they don't call them alcoholism, but we use the insurance first. If here's the thing about the laughter. You can't laugh about something that hasn't been healed. And if you hear people tonight laughing about stuff you don't think's funny, keep coming back. Because if it's happened for one of us, it can happen for all of us. We are not laughing at you. We're laughing at the joy of our release from those old ideas that held us captive for so long. Al-Anon is really only a program for people who are willing to work at it. And Al-Anon requires effort, ongoing effort. I'd like to say consistent, but we're not. It's just ongoing. We just can't stop. We got to keep going. I'm not an Al-Anon because of the people in my life, but an Al-Anon, the people in my life are what got me here. You know, they were my ticket in. I came in because of the first part of the first step, because I'm powerless over alcohol. I have stayed in Al-Anon because of the second part of the first step, because of the unmanageability of my own life, the unmanageability of my head, the unmanageability of my thoughts, the unmanageability of my fears. That's what's kept me in Al-Anon. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a 12-step recovery program that I practice like my life depends on it, because I am convinced today of the fatal nature of my disease. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a committed meeting that I go to every week like a doctor's appointment. And if you want to find me, you come Monday night at 6:15 to the Addison Al-Anon family group meeting, and that's where I'll be. And when I walk into that meeting, they go, "Oh, Ellen, there you are." Now, we could have gone to the meeting together on Saturday, and probably I talked to half of them on Monday. But that's the way we are at a meeting. It's one of the reasons I love these kind of weekends. You all probably go to meetings with each other on a regular basis, but the noise out there and the noise outside of you all seeing each other and going, "Oh, there you are, I hoped you were coming, there you are," and hugging and kissing and carrying on and patting each other on the bobo and doing whatever you're going to do out there, you know. They don't do this in other places, you know. This is not what happens at a corporate meeting someplace. People don't do this. This, just to be in the midst of folks doing that, even if you're not the one getting patted on the popo, which sometimes I just kind of sidle around, see if, but anyway, no. That's old behavior. Really, I don't. I told a girl in the bathroom, I'm standing there looking in the mirror, and I'm thinking to myself, this was not the outfit I planned. This was not it. I'm not good at planning outfits anyway, but this wasn't it. I had this really nice kind of a spring suit thing that looked really great till that monsoon blew through here a while ago. And I thought, I could have sworn I saw snow out there. Somebody said, "Oh, no, it's just the petals off the trees. It's not snow." But I've been buffaloed before, you know. And I said, "Nope, that's not working. I'm into the warm clothes. And I'm just a talking head up here anyway. What do you care what I have on?" So anyway, I told the girl in the bathroom, I said, "This is not what I had planned." And she said, "You're beautiful." I went, "Oh, that's good enough, thanks." They don't do that in corporate America either, let me tell you. But it happens here. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a sponsor whom I talk to on a regular basis. And she sends you her love, by the way. She told me not to screw up and make her look bad. Actually, the only thing she ever tells me when I go to talk is, "Don't forget to take clean undies." I don't know why that worries her so, but it does. I'm an Al-Anon, and I'm so grateful there's such a thing as Al-Anon to be. So this lady called me one day at work, and she was crying. And the primary alligator illusion is, when you're okay, then I'll be okay. And I have to do everything in my power to make you okay. I will go places I don't want to go with people I don't want to be with. I'll stay up when I'm tired and go to bed when I'm not. I'll eat when I'm not hungry and won't eat when I am. I'll sit up all night with your mother in the hospital when I don't like hospitals, and I certainly don't like your mother. But I'll do it. And it looks very loving and kind on the outside, and it is the most self-centered behavior on the planet. I don't do it because I care. I do it because I need a reaction back from you that'll make me okay. I need validation back from you. And if I don't get that back from you, it has nothing to do with whether you give it to me or not. It's just whether I can get it back or not. Then I'll do it harder. I'll do it on every Tuesday. I'll serve pork chops every time I do it. I used to take off my clothes. I don't do that anymore. I'm afraid now if I did it would have sort of the opposite effect it used to have, you know. People would go running from the room instead of making offers. Anyway. She started crying. I hadn't been in Al-Anon too awfully long, and the sponsor I had told me one time, she said, "You know, I believe that maybe the thing we do best for each other in Al-Anon is we attend each other's pain. We sit with each other when we hurt. We don't tell each other, 'Wipe that look off your face and get a better attitude, lady, and then you can come back to the next meeting.' We don't say, 'Boy, it would be a lot more pleasant in here if you had a smile on your face, you know.' We don't do that. We sit with each other when we hurt. One of the things my group decided years and years ago was that we would supply Kleenexes. We have 7 or 8 boxes of Kleenexes on our table because somebody cries at every Al-Anon meeting. It just happens. Sometimes because they hurt, sometimes because it's safe. But they cry in every meeting. And when somebody cries in our meeting, we do not shove the Kleenex at them. It's a very subtle way of saying, "Boy, I bet those tears are bothering you because they're sure bothering me. Suck them up." We don't do that. If they want the Kleenex, they're right there. If they want to slobber all over the table, we don't care. Go ahead. We all did it. Don't wipe your boogers on the nose, though. I mean, on the wall, though. Anyway. And when somebody is upset, we don't put our arms around them and tell them everything is going to be okay. Because we can't make that promise. You know, what I'm told in the book is I'm supposed to get up here and tell you what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like today. Not what it used to be like and what happened and what it's like today. Because there are plenty of times today when it still sucks. What's different today is how I respond to it. So when somebody cries in a meeting, we'll sit with them and we'll say, you know what, we can see you're in a lot of pain. And there are those among us who have had the same problem. Keep coming back. We'll do it with you. Whatever it is, you don't have to do it by yourself. But I know that. This lady's calling me. She's crying on the phone. All my alarms are going off. All my alligator alarms are going off, you know. And in my diseasiness, I will lie and I will cheat and I will steal. And she said, my husband is in a 12-step recovery program for his alcoholism, and I just want you to know that we're going to pay the school back all the money we owe you. It's just going to take us a while. And I said, oh, I understand. I understand. My husband drinks too much, too. I never said that to a soul before in my life. And that was not the problem. His drinking was not the problem. I grew up in a family of heavy drinkers. I grew up in a family that acted as if there was something the matter with people who didn't drink. You should stay away from them. They're fanatics. Some of them might even be Baptists. You know, today I know they never said that. That's just what I heard. I had this selective hearing thing, you know, that sort of hears what I want to hear or what I think I'm going to hear, and it has nothing to do with what you said. His drinking was not the problem. His not coming home was the problem. And, of course, I thought that was all about me. If I was a better wife, if I cooked better, if the kids were quieter, if I did something different, I could get him to come home. I just didn't know what it was I needed to do, and I sure wasn't going to tell somebody about that because it was obvious I was defective. What I didn't know is I was talking to somebody who was new in Al-Anon, and we're deadly when we're new. We got a lot of answers. We don't know what the questions are, but we got a lot of answers. And nobody told her she shouldn't hunt me, and she hunted me. She called me on a regular basis. It took about 6 months before I finally agreed to go to a meeting. And I went to a meeting because I'd been in a doctor's office, a psychologist's office, who worked for our school. And I'd been in his office the night before. And I'd reached a place in my life where all I could do was cry. Deciding what shoes to put on was a major decision. I would sit on the edge of my bed in the morning and cry over what shoes to wear. And he said, Ellen, I don't have your answers, and the only people who might have them are Al-Anons. And she called the next day. And I felt like I was coming out of the jungle with my arms up, surrendering to the enemy, you know, because, oh, my God, she was such a Nazi. I just knew that I was going to end up standing at the bottom of the escalator at the airport, you know, handing out pamphlets, witnessing for Al-Anon, you know. But I had no choice, and I landed in this nest of winners. They say you should stick with the winners. The deal is most of the time they don't have name tags on. They do this weekend. The winners are the ones who don't settle for the first miracle. The winners are the ones who don't just try to survive this deadly disease. They try to find how to live a new life. And I landed in the nest of those folks. They would call me up and they'd say, so-and-so is doing the steps across town tonight. We're all going to go. We'll come by and pick you up. Get in the car. I thought that was the first step of the program. Get in the car. They didn't say, do you want to go? Do you have time? Can you get someone to watch the kids? They said, we'll be there. You'll know us by the honk. You know, by God, I'm in the car. At first, he was a little upset about my doing this because he was pretty sure I was going because of him, and now everyone would know. This is the same guy who would back his truck in at 2:30, you know, in the morning, very, very drunk, had run the air conditioner all the way home, even though it was the middle of winter, so he wouldn't pass out on the way home. And then just as he backed his truck up, he would pass out on the horn so that everybody in the neighborhood knew. But he didn't want anyone to know I was going to Al-Anon. And I told him what you said, which was, I'm not going for you, I'm going for me. But I knew that was a big fat lie. You know, I was going because of him. That's the reason I was going. And after a while, it was okay with him that I went. Because the first thing they told me was, shut up. Shut up. Oh, just please shut up. Kindly shut up. And he caught on to that real quick. You know, my shutting up was a distinct difference from what we'd been getting at home before. And one Monday morning, this lady called me, and she said, I want to talk to you. She said, you know what? Your husband has been here with my husband all weekend long drinking. And I said, how can you do that? How can you, heart transplant someplace over here. How can you do that? How can you treat your wife like this? How can she put up with that kind of behavior? And he said, you'd found a way, and I should call you. He was 12-stepping for Al-Anon out there. She was too angry. She needed to stay angry because it was the only way she had any power at that home. Anyway, we rocked on like that, and we went through a difficult time, which is what happens in active alcoholism. And what ended up happening was within a couple of months, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I was 38 years old. I was too young to have breast cancer. I have no history of it in my family, but I had it. And I had a 60-40 chance of living another 5 years. And I've hung my life on a couple of lines out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of them is, nothing but nothing, anything happens by accident in God's world. Oh, I love that. And the other one is the last column of the four-step inventory that basically says, and what was your part? So first time it occurred to me that I had a part in everything that happened in my life. Not just some places and I was helpless victim in the others, but I had something to do in every area in my life. And what freedom that is to know that. You know, if I'm a helpless victim, there's nothing I can do about it. But if I had a part, there is something I can do. And I wanted to know what my part was in the cancer because I didn't want to die. I was 38 years old. I had two kids. You know, I had this husband that I absolutely adored. Apparently, almost to death, I adored him. There are probably people on the planet who can live life without written directions. I'm not one of them. And I'm so grateful that you gave me all of them when I got here. And I don't know if you're alcoholic and this weekend is your first experience at Al-Anon meetings, but you may have heard that we have the exact same 12 steps that you have, with the exception of one tiny little word in the 12th step. We're not allowed to carry messages to alcoholics anymore. ours says others, but it's a much bigger job. It's a much bigger job. Anyway, and I wanted to know what my part was, and the only thing I knew to do was inventory. And I got in a step study, and I worked with these other women, and I inventoried when the tumor was growing, and what I, you know, the thought came, and what I knew as a result of that inventory was that when I live in active alcoholism, I break out in malignancies. Cancer is prevalent in alcoholic homes. There were studies then that said cancer is a stress-related disease. There's nothing more stressful than active alcoholism. If there's something worse, I don't want to know. I don't want to be there. What I said for the umpty-umpth time and meant for the first time was, if you can't stay sober, you can't stay here. Because I knew I'd die. See, it finally got down to my life. And I said, if you can't stay sober, you can't stay here. And he couldn't stay sober, and he left. And if you ask him why he left, he would have told you it was that crazy daughter of mine that anyone who had to live with that little wench would drink to. I didn't drink. I just locked the door of her room and didn't go in there. I just stayed out. I had an arrangement with her. I said, you can keep that room the way you want it until you start to lower my property value. When you do that, I'm coming in. I knew she was crazy. She was just crazy. A couple of years later, they called from school, maybe 2 years later, they called from school and they said, there's something the matter with your daughter. And they said, we're going to send her for an evaluation. I said, really? And they said, yes. And 2 days later, the guy from the treatment center called and he says, Ms. Davis, don't know how to tell you this, but we do believe your daughter's alcoholic. And I said, yes! He said, we've not had a lot of mothers react like that. And I'm like, yes! It's alcoholism! Alrighty! I thought she was crazy. It's an Al-Anon disease. No sign she'll ever get any help for that, you know, but alcoholism, yes! She's 17. I can make her do stuff, you know. Bev taught me a thing years ago. Bev has helped me so much with my children. And she said, you know, there are mother things. There are things you have to do as a mother. And one of them is you have to know you've done everything you could do for your kid. You got to know you've done everything you could do for your kid. I don't want to ever have that question in my head, what if? What if, you know? And so, by God, I took her a place that would force feed the steps into her because that was the only thing I thought would work. And I want to thank all the alcoholics in the room for what you do and for why you do it. The statistics are that 80% of the young people who come in have to go back out because they're not through. And if you did this working with others for some kind of success rate or some kind of, you know, toaster or some reason, you know, that could get pretty depressing. I'm so glad you do it for the reason you do it, because my kid was one of those 80% who had to go back out. And it was much worse when she went back out the second time. She was gone for months on end. She left the state. She hung out in horrible areas of Dallas. She called me one night and she said, Mom, I got to have $300 by tomorrow morning or else. and I didn't have $300. And I had to say, baby, I don't have the money to give you. But when she came that first time, you didn't treat her like, because she was 17, she was somehow too young to be alcoholic. You didn't treat her like she hadn't suffered enough. You didn't treat her like, because she did drugs, it somehow negated her alcoholism. It was easier for her to get drugs than it was alcohol. The deal is, my daughter got sober twice before it was ever legal for her to drink once. My daughter sobered up on January 29th of 1990, and she is still sober. 17 years later, she is a member in good, that's your miracle. She's a member in good standing of an AA group to the north of me. And a couple of years ago, she asked me to come talk at her anniversary. And let me tell you, we have had very separate programs. And this thing happened all day long. You can see I don't know any short stories, but this thing happened. And Dick ended up in the hospital that day, and she was terrified that I wasn't going to be able to come talk at her anniversary that night. And she said, Beverly better be in town. And I said, she had this little girl voice going on. And I said, Mel, you know, it'll probably be okay. And she said, but Mom, you don't realize I've broken my anonymity. And for her, breaking her anonymity was telling people she was my kid. I don't care, truly. I do not care. Whatever it takes to keep her sober is A-okay with me. Okay, so Melissa's out there doing her thing, and when she was sober the first time, she started hanging out in slippery places, slippery people, and I said, if you drink, I'll die. And it's the way it felt, you know, it's the way it felt. And so I made these rules, and yeah, I set for the umpteenth time, I made the rules for the first time. I said, if you can't do this, you can't stay here. And the morning, and I planned the day to change, I was changing the locks and kicking her out. And I planned that morning to be the morning I was leaving to go to Crested Butte to be with 600 of my closest friends, because I didn't want to kick my daughter out. I love my daughter. I adore my daughter. I wanted my daughter healthy, happy, home, and hold, and she couldn't do any of those things. And that was the morning she threw herself across my bed and said, you're going to be a grandmother. She was 17, 18 and pregnant, and she had every intention of keeping the baby. And I thought it changed everything. I thought that meant I was going to have to stay home and take care of her, and I thought I'd die. And it took me a couple of hours to work through that before I could finally call my sponsor and tell her what was happening. And my sponsor said, do you want her to stay? I said, no, honestly, I don't want her to stay, and I feel terrible about that. Shouldn't mothers want their children at home? She said, no. There's no rule that says that. And she said, there's only so much pain in each interaction. The pain you're feeling is hers. Let it go and let her have it. And she said, if you don't want her to stay, I'll stay on the phone while you tell her. I can see the phone on the bed today, and I quit hurting when I put the phone down. The pain was not about letting her go. The pain was about holding on to her when it was time to let her go. She told me that the name of this planet is let go, let go, let go. And I told her she'd have to leave, and she went out, and we went through this horrible fall where she went around telling people what a horrible mother I was. She was pregnant, and I wouldn't let her be at home. And I did things like I went to the Brazos Riverside Conference, and my friend Buddy Ross was taping, and I said, Buddy, guess what? I was serious as a stroke, too. I said, Buddy, she's pregnant at me now. All about me. And Buddy was just as serious as he could be. And he said, oh, sweetie, he said, I understand, I really do. He said, but you know what? Our son's girlfriend had a baby out of wedlock, and that child has been the light of our lives. It never occurred to me I might like it. Because I had this big old idea, that said people should be married, they should be have gone to college, they should be grown, they should like babies. She didn't even like babies, you know. That's the way things should be. Al-Anon's allowed me to trash can one old idea at a time. Of course, then I make a new one. But, and I decided I could change my mind. I've loved babies all my life, and God was offering me a baby. And I was saying, yeah, but. You know, I think that the sanity we're offered in step two may be nothing short of paradise. But the reason we don't get paradise is because, yeah, but. Not today, God. Not this way to God. This isn't right, God. This shouldn't be happening. I'm telling God how he ought to be running his world. Al-Anon for me has been the journey from yeah, but to thank you. Thank you. Thank you for things exactly as they are. Now that to me is acceptance. There's a difference between tolerance and acceptance. Tolerance means I don't like it. It's not the way I want it. But I'll put up with it. Acceptance is gladly willing. I don't want it any different. I want it exactly the way it is. And so she called me a couple of months later, and she said, Mom, I had a sonogram done today. And she said, that blue blanket you're knitting, knit faster. It's twin boys. Oh, yeah. You know those alcoholics, if one's good, let's have another, you know. And I think to myself how different my life would be if she just had one. Thank you, God, she had two, you know. You might have another speaker if she just had one, but she had two. And it was too much for me. What an order. I couldn't go through with it. So babies are born, blah, blah, blah. There's a wonderful story of me and Bevan here that I wish I could tell you, but I can't tell you. And I'm running really quickly out of time, and I have so much life left to tell you. And all these people are coming in now thinking, where's the alcoholic? I thought we were supposed to have an alcoholic. She's right here. She's coming soon. It'll be okay. Just don't hum to yourself. Just kind of just stand there if you need to. Anyway, I love the look on their faces when they come in. It's like they turn around to the people and say, did you? This doesn't sound like. I was talking someplace one time, and it was everything was running really late, and I was really late, and this, you know, the doors open, and this swarm of people coming in thinking they're listening to the alcoholic, and they weren't there listening to me. And so later, I'm walking out through the crowd, you know, and there's this, you know, this guy passes me, and he goes, oh, are you the one up there? I went, yeah, he said, well, I came to hear the real speaker, but I heard you. Okay. I was just pantomiming up there anyway. Anyway, babies are born. Babies start going through a tough time. One of them has a hole in his heart and some other physical issues. And at 5 weeks, my daughter said, Mom, I'm not going to keep him, and you can have him. And, that was really quite the time in my life. And I never had to make such a hard decision. I never. And Al-Anons are not good at making decisions. We're really not. We're so afraid we might pick the wrong thing. What if next week something better comes along, you know? What if more is revealed means you just need to wait? And then you'll have more information. And then because what if you take this and you're stuck, you know, with this? And then this really fabulous thing comes and you can't have it, you know, because you're stuck back here. If you want to watch pain, watch a group of Al-Anons try to decide where to go for lunch. Oh, I don't care. Where do you want to go? I'm really not very hungry, Olive. You know. And thank God we have double winners, you know, who walk up and go, Mexican food, we're going for Mexican food. Oh, Mexican food, just what I wanted, you know. So trying to make a decision about these babies was way over my head. This was obviously a God deal. So God and my sponsor, and lots of writing and lots of talking, and my sponsor had been telling me for years that God wants for me what I want for me in my heart of hearts. I'm just so afraid I'm going to make the wrong decision. What if I don't pick the best dream? You know, what if there's a better dream and I don't even know about it yet? What do I do? And she said, sweetheart, here's the deal. Your job is walking in the direction of your dream. Where you get is God's deal. And God's promise to you is this or something better. God is not a terrorist waiting around the corner to test your patience. God really doesn't want to hurt you. God wants you happy, joyous, and free. God's never done a thing to torture you. God's tried to keep you out of the torture. God's tried to accompany you in the torture, but you go, no, 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 I must feel this myself. I decided I didn't want to be their mom. They're the children of two addicts, and I didn't like the odds, and I'm through raising kids, but I decided I really, 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 really wanted to be their grandmother. So my daughter signed power of attorney over to me, and I went to adoption agencies, and I said, I'm looking for a family that wants two babies and a grandmother. I've learned in Al-Anon that if you don't ask, you aren't going to get it. And we thought it would take weeks, it took months, and when they were just about 5 months old, we found the family who didn't care that there were two babies, didn't care that one of them had some physical issues, didn't care that the grandmother wanted to stay involved. They said, if it's God's will. And when my daughter heard them say that, she said, I picked them. I said, I picked them too. They let me pick the day to surrender the babies because it's the hardest thing I ever did in my whole life was to give up those babies. So I picked the day to be the day I was going to Crested Butte to be with 600 of my closest friends because I needed intensive care. And on our way to Crested Butte, on my way to Crested Butte, my son and my daughter and I took our babies and we handed them over to their new parents because they agreed to meet us that morning and let us see them. And the boys turned 19 this last March. Oh, yes, they've only been in jail, I think, 4 times between them. One of them just doesn't get it that the rules are for everybody, you know. And the other one was picked up just inside Walmart with the latest illegal addition to his ladies' underwear collection that he had at home. And the parents have aged like 20 years, you know, in the last 4 or 5. They're just great, and the mother has this twitch thing going. She's got the twitch now, you know. And they'll tell me stuff about them, and, finally at one point I had to say to them, if I thought they were going to be easy to raise, I'd have kept them, you know. But, until they graduated from high school last year, every month I had a meal with them. Every month they met me, and I had time with those boys. They came and spent time with me in the summer. They came every Christmas. They came every Easter. I'm their grandmother. I've always been their grandmother. It took them till they were about 10 to realize something very strange about our family because their mother was older than their grandmother, and they never were sure whose mother was I anyway, you know. And their parents waited for them to ask questions, which with boys can take a very long time. And when the boys finally asked, they started telling them. The boys are like, wow, you know. And we went through a year, me and the guys, with them saying to me, I'd go pick them up, or I'd see them for lunch or whatever, and they'd say, Grandma, why didn't you keep us? Didn't you want us? Don't you wish I was your little boy? And I got to work through that with them. And I got to work through that for me. And I got to the place where I said, here's the truth. What I wanted was I wanted you to have a grandmother. I wanted there to be somebody who didn't care what your room looked like or what your grades were or what your mouth was like, who loved you no matter what you did. And if I'd have kept you, you'd have never had that. But right now, you got somebody who loves you no matter what. And they know that for a fact. One of them was working Easter and couldn't come, so we thought the other one was working too and wouldn't come. And Easter Sunday, I opened the door because the parents and their other kid, who's also my grandchild now, when they came, I opened the door thinking it's Ruby and Don and Alicia, and I opened the door, and there's Tony. And he's grinning just big because he knew he surprised me. He knew I almost wept. I was so happy to see him. We have a relationship with that family that I couldn't describe to you if I tried. About the time the babies left, I decided to quit dating. I'd done another inventory, and I discovered since I was 12, I'd been chasing after, catching, going with, waiting for, engaged to, married to, divorced from, engaged to, married to, divorced from somebody. But there'd always been somebody. I walk with this big hole beside me, and I throw people into the hole to try to make me enough. I'd like to tell you they're all very special, but I don't remember most of their names. And if you're not going to hang out with boys, it leaves you one other choice. And it's nothing personal, girls. I just don't like you much. That's all. I'm really not a girly girl. I'm not. I shop like a man. I don't understand this. Oh, let's go shopping for the day. Shoot me. Just shoot me. I shop like a man. If you don't know what you want, do not go in there. If you know what you want, go get it and get out. We have other places to go. If you have something to say to me on the phone, for God's sake, say it. Don't just say, I'm busy. I'm very busy. But I had nothing to do but hang out with girls. And so I would hang out with the girls, and I'd say, I have this big old Suburban. We're going to the conference this week, and I'd love it if you'd come ride with me. And if you have to have 12 pairs of shoes for a friggin' 3-day conference, okay. I can do the whole thing in my Reeboks, but if you need, like 12 pairs of shoes, I have a lot of room, bring them on. And okay, every time you have to pee, we will stop the car. Women are so amazing. They're driving down the road. Oh, look, there's a bathroom. Do I have to pee? Yes, I do. Stop. It's like, I think I could make it to Kansas. I really do, but stop the car. And okay, every time we see a Walmart, we'll go in. Oh. That was just the biggest concession I could make, was we were going in Walmart. I now believe that there should be red neon crosses in the front of Walmart, because I believe healing happens in the aisles of Walmart. That's where I was healed, in the aisles of Walmart, over a $5 bathing suit that looked like it would dissolve if you ever wore it in water, you know. We laughed till I thought we were going to have to call for cleanup on aisle 12, you know. See, I always wanted God to talk to me in thunder and lightning. As you can see, drama is my life. And I made a wonderful discovery in that time with the girls, and that was that God speaks to me in the language I understand best, and the language I understand best is usually another woman. God said, Ellen, if I did the thunder and lightning, you'd miss the message and you'd get lost in the messenger one more time, you know. But I understood, and what I understood as a result of that is that it was the best gift I've ever gotten, which is I'm enough. I'm enough. No one has to be added to make me okay. I really am just fine, just the way I am. So then this dude asked me out, and we'd known each other a long time, and the Alateens had made a list for me. Single and sober was tied for first place, since I had a little problem with married men. And then there was sexy, spiritual, and solvent was all the next things, all S's. They said, you're looking for Superman. Why, indeed I am. And I knew he was not Superman. And I wasn't going to get messed up with somebody who wasn't in the program, done that enough, not going to do it again. Well, here we are, of course. And we've been married a couple of years, and of course, if he's going to hang out with me, he's going to have to hang out with you. You're my people, you know. And he thought you were really funny. A bit too emotional for him, but really funny. And we were at a conference, and it had been a hard year, and my sponsor told me I'd had to do a written first step, and that we were going to have to do that at dinner. So I sat at dinner with her, and I was giving her my first step, and the most painful thing I had was his snoring. I mean, that was the thing I was angriest about, you know. I loved him, but I thought of stories in the middle of the night about what I was going to tell God happened to him after I killed him, you know. And then the next thing I turned over was his drinking. He was not an abusive drunk. He didn't stay out late nights, but he would come home. I'd open the door, and I'd go, hello. And if I smelled alcohol, my night went to hell in a handbasket. I needed to know he'd drink, and I'd be okay. An hour later, he walked up to the podium, got a chip, said he was an alcoholic. He's not had a drink since then. The best thing I ever did for him was the best thing I ever did for my daughter, which was get a program, get a life, and get out of your way and let you do what you need to do. A couple of years later, my son, you know, I told you I was just hurt when I got here. I wasn't angry, but I'll tell you something. I was rageful, and I pinned my children to the wall with my rage. They were the only people who saw me angry. About 10 and a half years ago, my son called, and he said, Mom, we want you to quit your job and stay home. We're pregnant, and we want you to take care of our baby. My husband went, No, we need that money you're making, which was about a quarter of what he was making, but we needed that money. And I recognize financial insecurity when I see it. Okay. A couple of months later, my daughter called, living in California. Mom, guess what? We want you to quit your job and stay home. We're pregnant and we're coming home. And I said, now? And he was, no. So he happened to hear a tape, a Clint H. tape, where somebody asked Clint exactly how much money would you have to have so you wouldn't feel financially insecure. And Clint said, just enough money so I wouldn't have to trust God. Loving that, aren't you? You're getting the gift. That's it. And that was when he went, okay. So I opened a little business called Mom's Better Babies, affordable daycare for your priceless children. But the only children I took care of were my grandchildren, so don't ask. And for 9 years, I had the best job any human ever had. Madison came to me in August. She was exactly to the day the same age the twins were the day we gave them up. 4 months later, Tristan was born, and at 3 weeks old, he came to stay with me. 14 months later, Kennedy was born, and at 4 weeks old, she came to stay with me. And 7 months later, Sutton was born. And at 2 months, he came to stay with me. My son had two daughters, my daughter had two sons, and they had sense enough to have them in 3 years. And it's been the best job any human could ever have. I can go to work in my pajamas. I could sleep with my clients. They even paid me to do that, you know, to sleep with them. My client said, I love you, Mimi, on a real regular basis, you know. I got a call one day. My sponsor of many, many years was dying, and they said she had 2 weeks to a month, and I was fractured, to say the least. And I said, tell her I can't come today or tomorrow. I got the kids, but I'm coming Saturday. I'll be there Saturday. And I had to jam all my little kids in the car. They must have been about 1, 2, 3, and 4 or something at the time. And I'm jamming them all into the car. And I apparently was a little brusque putting them into the car. And Tristan reached over and he patted me on the arm. And he said, Mimi, breathe in, breathe out. It was my sponsor coming out of this kid's mouth, you know. And Madison said, Mimi, nobody in here but us chickens. Focus on who's in front of you. It was a fabulous job, and it ended way, way too soon. I never suffered empty nest before, but you know, Al-Anon has allowed me to do full circle on so many things in my life. Yeah, I changed the locks on both my kids, but when these kids left, I suffered empty nest, and I went into a depression, and I really was hard to have them go. I was so used to having them every day, and now I see them maybe once a month, but I have this fabulous husband who loves these babies, and they love him, and we take them on spring break trips, and we take them every summer to the Crested Butte Mountain Conference. I cannot keep alcoholism from touching them. I cannot keep that from happening. But maybe, just maybe, what I can do is I can make AA and Al-Anon safe words for them, a safe place for them, so that when it does touch them, it won't be so hard to come. I used to think that when I died and went to heaven, God was going to say, pull out the VCR and the tape, and I want to, well, actually it was an 8-track originally, but then it moved up to VCR and a tape, and I want to see how her husband and her children turned out, and if they turned out to be fine, upstanding members of the community, she's earned her way into heaven and she can come in. I am so grateful that you let me find another God. I'm not sure what's going to happen when we're done here, but I tend to make up stories when I don't know what's going to happen, and I live in my little stories. This is a story my sponsor said I could have. What I think is, when my body gets tired of doing whatever in the world it is we're doing here, and that little part of me that's always been God's anyway goes to wherever it is God is, when I get there, God's going to go, oh, Alan, there you are. You know, sweetheart, heaven's heaven when you're not here, but it's just not perfect without you. And he's going to say, I have been running a little experiment down there, and I know you've been paying close attention. This is not a test, nothing you could pass or fail. I just want to know how it's going. First off, let me ask you, did you have a good time? You know, there was nothing I did to torture you. There was no reason for flowers to be different colors, except I thought it might make you smile. And I knew you'd love babies, so I put a lot of them in your life. And I hope you didn't miss them. And because of you, I'm going to be able to say, oh, yes, God. I had a wonderful time at your party. Thanks for asking me. And the second thing he's going to say is, were you Ellen? You were the only one like that I made. I had things for you to do that nobody else could do. I had things I needed you to do because my hands are too big. And that worried me for a long time because I've lived so much of my life trying to be what I thought other people wanted me to be, trying to do what I thought other people wanted me to do. I didn't know if I had ever been me. I do a written inventory every night, and one of the lines is, I added a line for a couple of years that said, today, Ellen. And I wrote down what I knew was mine to do today. This was mine to do today. You could have had another speaker and been done 10, 15 minutes ago, but that's not what happened to you. Lila's a very patient woman. She's just waiting. This was mine to do. And after a couple of years, I looked at that list of things, and 99% of it was what you'd call service work. And the last thing he's going to say is, precious, did you ever get the joke? You know, I got the joke the year of cancer. I got the joke standing at the back door with all the hair on my body missing. Not because I did it. It just went away, except for the gray, which kind of blew around like nerve endings, you know, on the top of my head. And, oh, it was a very strange-looking body. And I got ready to go outside that day, and I looked down and realized I was going to have to go back in and shave my legs. I had lost all the hair except under my arms and on my legs. I had a 60-40 chance of living another 5 years. I had this crazy daughter who was living over the edge of the planet someplace. I had a husband who would say, what's for dinner, and then not come home for 2 weeks. And I had a son who was disappearing a moment at a time. He slept all day, and he stayed awake all night. And the fact of the matter is, right that minute, I was just fine. I was just fine. I laughed. I could hear God laughing in heaven, rolling around the floor of heaven over that whole thing. And see, I've spent so much of my life afraid of what I'm not going to get, or afraid someone's going to take from me what I think I need, that I almost miss the miracle, which is right here. May you find him now, right here, right now. I almost miss the miracle that is me. There's a guy in our group that says the glass isn't half full or half empty, the glass is just too damn big. Bill Cosby says the glass is either half full or half empty, depending on whether you're drinking or pouring. The magic of what's going on up here is that when I get through sharing my story, I'm the one whose cup overflows, and I thank you.